Good morning. Talking to an automated voice probably isn't on your list of favorite things. So what other jobs may soon be overtaken by automation? Think Tank leader Jerry Mikowski kicks off our series, The Last Job in Hawaii. On the flip side, Honolulu Charter Amendment question asks whether we need the Office of Climate Change, Sustainability, and Resiliency, likely staffed by real people. Law professor Maxine Burkett gives us her critique. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk. Ayoka is a Nigerian-American World Poetry Slam champion, recording artist, and TED fellow who's coming to a weekend arts festival. She's with us in our studio. And what happens to families when their matriarch is getting along in years and wants no part of the old folks' home?
It's Wednesday, October 26th. That's The Conversation, coming your way after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vanderkook.
And I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And we have some new listeners to welcome later
today. Well, we will be welcoming listeners later on today as HPR2 in East Hawaii gets turned on. That'll be at 91.3. We're all looking forward to that much later today. And meanwhile, HPR1 will be found at 89.1 for East Hawaii listeners. A very exciting day, really.
Yeah.
The fulfillment of a promise, and we're all, you can just feel how electric it is.
That's
around
right,
here.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, we have some electric things to talk about here on Oahu and throughout the islands, and we hope you'll stay with us for the hour. Now, for Oahu voters yet to cast their ballots, part of this election experience is including answering 20 amendment questions that could change Honolulu's charter. It's a once-in-10-year opportunity to modernize what amounts to the city's constitution. One of the questions, number 7, asks whether the city should create an Office of Climate Change, Sustainability, and Resiliency. UH Law School professor Maxine Burkett teaches climate change law and policy, ocean and coastal law, and international environmental law. I asked her for her read of Charter Question 7 and whether it could create more focus or additional bureaucracy.
The Office of Climate Change, Sustainability, and Resilience is incredibly important if we're thinking about how disasters occur. And there's the disaster itself, and then there's the preparedness of the community. This office is looking squarely at preparing our city and county, the resilient infrastructure, et cetera, to be better prepared in the face of those disasters. No one wants a sprawling bureaucracy. I certainly do not want that. In fact, I think this will ensure efficiency in the city. It will allow us to not just focus on putting out fires, but to look at the horizon with respect to the changes that are coming our way and that are already evidenced in our current weather patterns and the extremes that we're seeing.
A lot of people hear that term, going to save us money, and that automatically makes them shudder. Because we've had lots of things come our way where we've been told, yes, it's going to have long-term savings. But if you were to detail how you think that would happen now with the creation of a new department, how do you reconcile those two things?
Yeah, I mean, what we know is that there are two kinds of sort of cost considerations here. One is that we have just been awarded the 100 Resilient Cities Award from the Rockefeller Foundation. So we have as a city an opportunity here with the Chief Resilience Officer position being funded by this award. In addition to that, a resiliency plan is being funded by this award. This is one private foundation. There is federal money. There's other foundations that are eager to support communities in being more resilient to the impacts of climate change. So in some respects, we're leaving money on the table by not having an infrastructure, an office, one advocate that has access to the agencies and can coordinate. Without having that position settled, we're leaving money on the table that we might otherwise have access to ensure our resilience. I would also say that, again, when we're looking at the costs, oftentimes we're not considering the costs of climate. And the costs of climate are near-term. They're present-day when we're dealing with heavy flooding events, for example, and the impacts on our infrastructure. But over time, that is going to increase. It's not a steady state. We're not at a new normal, so to speak. We're at a rate of change that's going to continue to change at an increasing rate. So what we're looking at is increased costs. And without actually having the other side of the ledger, what it costs not to act, we're not actually assessing cost appropriately. So this sort of ounce of prevention is certainly worth the pound two or three of cure.
for the long term. Is there a better way that you see that we could be coordinating both state and city efforts, or does that hang on Charter Question 7?
I think that hangs on Charter Question 7, largely because we have no point person that's doing this work now. We could be much better coordinated with both our federal and state partners. And from my understanding, there is an effort to really keep the independence of each level of governance separate. We have, as a city and county, responsibility for maintaining infrastructure and for making decisions about new developments, those kinds of decisions. The state can only intervene when it makes sense. But if we have an entity that can facilitate the coordination between what the state efforts are long term, other counties, we're that much more ahead of the game as a city. Again, I think we'll be missing a very important opportunity to look at the horizon and to understand that any disaster that we're preparing for really requires community planning and, again, cross-agency and cross-level coordination.
Are there cities that are doing this particularly well that might be a good model for Honolulu?
Definitely. In fact, the New York Times did a really fun article on where you might want to go as climate change worsens. And you may be surprised to know that it's New York City was at the top of the list. New York is a massive city. It's at least 8 to 9 times our size in terms of population, tons of coastline in all of the boroughs, and a very intimate relationship with disaster and disaster preparedness. Again, it's not just the storm event, it's the preparedness of the city infrastructure to protect citizens and, of course, the ability to respond to shocks. So in those circumstances, post-Sandy, New York City did not sit back. It did not do anything but squarely address the issues of resilience and sustainability and propel their efforts in that regard. And they have an office similar to what we're trying to build here in Hawaii.
And who more our size would you compare us to? Who's doing it really well?
Places like Portland, Maine are also doing it well. We have small towns that are, again, coastal that can be understood as resilient communities. Resilience is being able to respond in time to a storm and then bounce back quickly after an event, whether it's a flooding event or other slow onset concerns like sea level rise. So we have places that we can model and we can partner with that are more our size. And then we also know that much bigger places with as many, if not more, assets are also able to do it relatively efficiently and elegantly, which is what we hope to see here.
We're not going to know if this passes until we get through the election. But should it not pass, what do you see as recourse for city and county to be able to pick up some of this work that clearly you say needs to get done and done in concert with the state?
Yeah, I think it would be a real missed opportunity if it didn't pass. We have only a once every 10-year opportunity for us to consider the way we structure and coordinate along this very important issue. And, of course, in 10 years, the climate will look even more daunting, I think, had we not acted today. But the alternatives would be for the mayor himself to be able to create such a position and to integrate it into the city government. There are also opportunities for city council to make better decisions around restrictions on development and those sorts of things.
Would those also be able to be funded by the Rockefeller Foundation funds now, or is that restricted to it being changed through government in this way?
Well, it's unclear. My understanding, of course, is that there are better options for accessing these funds when you have an infrastructure where you have an office or a particular position that is in charge of making sure that money is put to good use. So, again, I think what we have is a very smooth transition into an entity that can manage this in the city government with the current funding that we have and can leverage future funding opportunities after that.
I hear you say that in your mind, it's a good idea that we do the charter amendment as such now. But even if that weren't to happen, that this office is still necessary and it would be incumbent upon the mayor to create that and that there might very well be funds for that. So it wouldn't necessarily come out of taxpayers' pockets.
We're hoping it would minimize the cost to taxpayers. But again, there are many costs to taxpayers. Our lack of sort of ideal energy efficiency, any kind of infrastructure damage that we're absorbing because we haven't been prepared is something that the taxpayers will also be subject to. So I actually think this is a much cheaper option. It's much more efficient. It's more protective of lives and property. So my hope is that this is just speculation, that in fact we do support the Charter Amendment Number 7 because of all of the promise and possibility it provides for our city.
And that it may be looked at more seriously in that way than if the mayor were simply just to create the position?
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is something that would be mandated by our electorate, and that's a much stronger position, and it endorses much sounder planning over time as a result.
And potentially, from what I'm hearing you say, also getting more money.
Yes, I think so. There are opportunities there. We don't want to miss them. And, of course, saving money, that's a big element of this, too, and avoiding the second disaster, which is the lack of preparedness that we can experience if we're not more resilient.
Maxine Burkett, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Maxine Burkett teaches climate change law and policy, ocean and coastal law, and environmental law at the William S. Richardson School of Law. Her work has been cited by BBC Radio, the ABA Journal, and the New York Times. A link to Honolulu Charter Amendment Question 7 is on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's 8:14 and coming up, slam poet and singer Ayoka visits our studio. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we remember a British naval officer of the 19th century who brought to an end an unauthorized, entirely illegal takeover of the Hawaiian kingdom. The takeover was the work of an officer under his command, one Captain Lord George Paulet, who sailed to Oahu in 1843 and became embroiled in a local land dispute involving British subjects. The reigning monarch, Kamehameha III, was off island at the time, and Paulet refused to negotiate with his representatives. When the dispute continued, Paulet threatened the fragile kingdom with force of arms and took over the government, raising the Union Jack over the islands and ordering Hawaiian flags destroyed. After 6 months, his commanding officer ordered the kingdom restored to its rightful ruler. The Hawaiian flag was raised in a Honolulu park that now bears the commanding officer's name. And that's the name we're looking for this morning. If you know it, call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Aloha, I'm James Macy from Makakilo. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
Ayoka is a poet and singer, a Nigerian-American performing artist, for whom music, words spoken and sung, and spectacle merge. Her African heritage is very much in evidence in her work, as is her unfettered curiosity about the world. Curiosity and creative freedom are qualities she wants to help others find within themselves, and she's offering a workshop with that goal in mind at HPR this Friday. She's with us now in our studio. Good morning, Ayoka.
Good morning. It's so wonderful to be here with you guys today.
You got me thinking about the relationship of curiosity to creativity, and I think maybe that's where creativity starts.
I agree. My goal is to demystify the creative process, and I know that there's a way to integrate that into anything that you're doing in life.
That's a great perspective to be taking because, you know, In African culture, in tribal culture, creativity is not restricted to a select few. It's what everyone does, right?
Absolutely. It's what you breathe. You know, I have an idea that if I bring an ukulele to Nigeria, to Edo State, Nigeria, in the village, the children and the young adults would have an amazing time doing incredible things with that instrument. And that's one of my goals, to figure out what cultures can evolve an instrument that I believe that instrument has traveled a long way, and I wanted to see where it goes when we go back to Edo State, Nigeria.
Some of the world's great guitarists are African guitarists, and they've rethought the instrument. And it reminds me of the way Hawaiians rethought the guitar in the 19th century, you know, approached it and sort of took an instrument, as would happen with an ukulele, right? Just find what you can do with it without any preconceptions.
Exactly. I want to say Portugal might have been one of the origins of that instrument.
It was, yeah.
And it found its way all around the world. And for me, it's a peaceful instrument. And so my next project, which is the Paper Hearts Forecast, is a web series and a podcast. And my goal is to use those beautiful rhythms mm-hmm. that are available to us and the beautiful tones that are available to us with that.
What's great about taking an instrument like that or any kind of creative tool to a different place is it gets used in the manner of the people there.
Exactly. Right? Yep. And my goal when I introduce an audience to my work, just like this Friday at the Atherton Studios, I hope everyone can show up there because what we really want to do is integrate in a community process. You know, I really want to integrate you into the Soul Map Life Script, which is my creative process. And it's innovation driven, which means that it can reach anyone.
What does it start with in an individual?
Good question. The first step is an intention. Setting an intention, whether it's time or moment, what do you want to achieve? And the second step after intention is to think of a symbol and putting that symbol in the middle of your heart as a core. And if you have a page, you put that in the page. And after that, it's associations. How many associations can blossom from that core symbol?
So I'm trying to think of what an example of that would be with an individual. You start off by saying what's important to you?
Yeah, so for me, music is and evolution is important. And so this is an example of a soul map life script. I do this. It's a snapshot and it's a blueprint every morning. My core symbol here in this case is a flower with a music symbol blooming in the middle. And so what happens is everything around that is my association. So TED Women is beginning today in San Francisco. And I'm here as a correspondent speaking to women about community and about how they balance wholeness and balance. And so the question is, what's the Paper Hearts forecast? What's your forecast? You know, maybe this morning I'm feeling clear. I'm feeling level-headed, and I want to be able to speak that truth.
So I would start by drawing a symbol which has resonance for me.
Absolutely.
And then I would, on a piece of paper, free associate
Absolutely. With it. Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's in the spirit of Mind Mapping by Tony Buzan, mm-hmm. which I've been studying for 20 years, and it's finally clicked in my own personal creative process. So it's my mission this next year is to travel around the world and teach people this method.
One of the things about bringing out creativity in oneself is that it frequently involves something that you might have to study for 20 years before it clicked.
Absolutely.
And that calls for a certain amount of patience in a very instant gratification age.
Absolutely. In my case, it was medicine. I studied medicine for 20 years. I went to Northeastern College of Pharmacy, and it was always my goal to find a way to integrate the medicine and the healthcare into the music. And I finally found my role in the world. The pharmacist is in, and I really want to write a book about drug interactions in the music industry. There's a lot of dysfunction that I'm aware of, and my goal is to combat that and have conversations, particularly with women. But I'm happy to talk to you, Chris, because we're not leaving the men out. And so I'm
glad to hear it.
Yes. Yes. So I'm here today to speak about that, about the Paper Hearts forecast and our web series and our invitation for people to come visit us on Friday and on Sunday, Saturday on the main stage at Hullabaloo.
Well, let's leave some time for you to sing a little bit.
Oh, I would love that. Absolutely.
Because we've only got a couple minutes left. What have you got that you could sing?
Do you want to play a track or you want to do something live? Because we were thinking of
something
Black Coffee.
Live.
Something live. Okay. Well, I have my octacajon here. Uh-huh. And I have my poem for the Soul Map Life Script book that I'd like to share with you. Mm-hmm. When I sit down to write, I have my equanimity. I have my humanity. I have my breath. I have no fear of interruptions. I meet one true space to be inside my body. I have everything I need to fill into the unfolding. Here I reach for a supersonic stratosphere in every breath I take. With each inhalation, I break open layers until every blink is a snapshot. Acknowledge the earthquake and reshape the landscape. Rest the voice and calm the mind. No matter what, arrive. SoulMap Life Script. And this is Ioka. I'm giving snapshots of the SoulMap Life Script book and talking here with Chris at
Arrive Harvard. Where?
Arrive here to the core of who I am. After I know myself, well, I move myself again and again. I make a dash to ancient realms. Melanin is a magnet in preparation for exposure to sunlight. It keeps going on and on. I'm a poet.
When you arrive at that place, that's then the creativity can flow outward from there. Is that what you're saying?
It's refillable. It's refillable. It's sustainable. And it's the truth of who we are. It's the balance. And that's what I want to promote. I want to promote that conversation around the world with women.
For all the struggles of the creative life, the rewards are intense when you get to that place, aren't they?
Yes, it's a journey from dysfunctional melancholy to thriving, to surviving. And that's my goal, to promote, to celebrate, especially to celebrate on Saturday and Friday with all of you.
You might just have defined the blues in terms of that journey from dysfunctional melancholy to thriving.
God bless you for calling that out, Chris. Thank you. And a shout out to my sorors, Delta Sigma Theta Sorority Incorporated. We want to invite all of those communities to come and celebrate in community with us.
Thanks for coming in. Ioka will offer a special show at Hawaii Public Radio's Atherton Studio on Friday called Ioka's Paper Heart. It's a workshop focused on helping you capture your creative spark. She and the band Quadrophonics will perform at the Hullabaloo Music and Art Festival Saturday at 9 p.m. on the Hawaii State Art Museum front lawn.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
What happens when pilot error, lack of training, and command problems combine? In a Marine helicopter flight last January, the mix brought tragedy. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has the details of the report on the crash. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Yeah, this is not a happy thing to note, yeah. But especially remembering what happened earlier this year when those 12 Marines were killed in the crash. What did we hear from this report, aside from what we just talked about in the opening?
Well, first, I got to give credit to the investigative reporting program at UC Berkeley. They were the ones to break this story. They got a copy of the Marine Investigation Report, and they shared that with us first. And remember, this was in January. This was about a mile and a half offshore Haleiwa, two Marine helicopters. And so what happened was one helicopter was trailing the other. This was in the evening. It was a complex nighttime training mission. And the helicopter that was trailing tried to catch up with the lead helicopter, accelerated. Well, at that same time, the lead helicopter suddenly made a sharp turn and the two collided. The impact was so strong, so powerful, estimated at hundreds of times the force of gravity. And, of course, there was a huge fireball. All 12 Marines died. So what happened? Well, you said a couple things at the top. Clearly, the pilots themselves had said that they didn't have enough experience flying with these training hours, not enough to execute even basic tasks. At least two of the pilots didn't have enough experience flying at night in tactical formation or using night vision goggles. One naval analyst described that as, and I'm quoting here, bordering on criminal negligence.
I mean, why on earth would they be allowed to go out if they didn't have that experience? And you've just said that, you know, that at least from one source we're hearing that this is criminal negligence. What does the Marine Corps say about this?
Well, the Marine Corps just issued a brief statement, acknowledged low aircraft readiness led to inadequate pilot efficiency. They blame some human factors, lack of focus. But a very revealing thing that the report discovered is that the lieutenant colonel who was in charge of the helicopter squadron was dismissed just 3 days before the accident. He was dismissed mainly because there was a lack of confidence in his ability to improve aircraft readiness. Well, on the very day of the accident, the new commander, his first day on the job, he promised to get the squadron flying, and he sent them up that same night. Well, the investigation found that that change in command, it was really a disruption and a distraction for that squadron's, you know, really screwed up their daily routine, and that was definitely a factor in what happened.
So you're talking about safety at the expense of expediency.
Yeah, that's one way to put it. You know, I should tell you also that this project that UC Berkeley is working on, this story came from a larger project looking at safety records of helicopters. These particular helicopters, they are the oldest and the largest that the Marine Corps uses, and not surprisingly, among the military's most crash-prone aircraft. So the takeaway, the reality check from all of this is that tragedy, as terrible as it was, it highlights a systemic problem that has really plagued the Marine Corps for many years regarding these heavy-lift helicopters.
And we're going to have to wait to see what happens to stop this from happening in future.
Yeah.
All right. We'll see if we get any word about that. Thanks, Chad. Thanks for bringing us the story.
Sure. Thanks, Bethann.
Everyday Chad Blair from Civil Beat joins us with a reality check. When was the last time you called a company and had a real person answer the phone? How often do you do your banking with the auto teller? For most of us, these experiences are daily occurrences, and in the coming years, we'll have more of them as simple and complex jobs replace people with automation. Despite the forecast for this trend, we're also told that the average person will have at least 10 jobs during her working life. But in the near future, what kinds of jobs will they be? Today, we start our series, The Last Job in Hawaii. We call Jerry Mulkowski, the head of the think tank REX, that stands for the Relationship Economy Expedition, to find out if companies, their human resources departments, and independent HR firms are taking notice of the growing movement toward job automation.
Employment companies and HR departments, two sides of that marketplace, seem to mostly be behind this. They're still operating from a traditional perception of human resources. The smarter of them, the more advanced of them, have changed themselves into talent management. Companies are beginning to realize that working for a company is more and more optional. And what they need to do is make companies these delightful places for workers to work. And that's not traditionally what HR did. It was mostly, hey, here's a job rec. Here are the things we require as prerequisites, or we won't even look at the candidate. And then we're going to slot the candidate into a spot in the old career fish ladder that they're going to have to climb, and that's going to limit what they're allowed to do and see and be and do and all that kind of thing. And a lot of those notions are flying out the window, which is kind of the good news of the new economy. And the bad news is that I'm unclear, and I think we're mostly unclear, about which jobs survive into that next era.
So as you look out now, and granted, here we are in fall of 2016, looking out at the coming years, what sectors do you see as being most vulnerable to automation, just to give us a baseline?
The whole question is, of course, complicated, and sort of it depends is a reasonable answer, but really you can see a lot of things happening. When I started in tech was back in 1987, and I joined at a moment when neural networks were getting their second lifetime. We're now in the third or fourth lifetime, and all this talk about deep learning and machine intelligence, a lot of it is based on these neural networks. But what I learned back in 87 was that when you looked at a problem like handwriting recognition, it turned out that that was really a sequence of problems. There were a whole series of finely detailed problems in there that needed to be conquered and then assembled together, that needed to coordinate. And I think that's what's happening now is that the geeks behind the scenes, behind the curtain, are figuring out they have enough data collected and they have enough understanding of how these things work that they can start knocking off task after task after task. So self-driving cars, for example. I'm on the side that, and I say this regretfully, but I think robo-cars and robo-trucks are coming faster than we expect. And it turns out that trucking is one of the largest employers as an industry in the country. There are lots and lots and lots of truckers. Now, if you've ever shadowed a trucker for a day, you know that what happens at the loading dock is really hard to automate. But the long haul, or, you know, the drive on the freeway from A to B, that could easily be automated because robots don't fall asleep, robots don't need retirement accounts, robots don't time out from driving after a certain number of hours. It's just that their batteries wear out, or they're, you know, they run out of fuel, whatever it might be. So trucking, I think, is a big one. And then as you move around, you start seeing other kinds of industrial automation, whether it's for agriculture or for other kinds of things. And here you have to distinguish between physical robots that are doing something like picking strawberries in a field or pineapples versus software automation, where a piece of something might then be taken away and be done by a computer.
So put those ideas into some job categories so that people get a really good sense of what you're talking about when you're talking about, you know, software automation versus having a robot do something, whether it be sitting there as a concierge or something else.
We've already been seeing a lot of automation. You know, automated teller machines replace bank tellers. And then when you dial any place, you mostly get sort of a jungle of press one to not talk to an attendant kind of thing. And more companies have realized that the more they can do self-service, where the burden of service is on us, the less it costs them to serve. The smarter companies then realize that they still need human attendants to give the human touch and to do the difficult stuff and to really build relationships. And that's good, but I think those companies are in the minority. The larger number of companies, the larger proportion of them are busy just trying to get rid of human labor costs. And this is happening all over the place. So name your service industry, and you can go down to maybe burger flipping, and there's, you know, McDonald's and others are looking at automating a fast food restaurant. But then you can go sort of up the economic ladder of tasks and look at lawyers and researchers and analysts. It turns out that legal documents and simple journalistic articles and all that are already being processed by AI or machine learning of different kinds. It turns out that x-rays, once the performance of a pattern recognition system is better than a human, then why bother with the humans, right? We have to kind of look around and figure out how we're going to survive. There's a phrase here that's, it's kind of a techie phrase, but it's an important phrase. It's called staying ahead of the API, or staying above the API. An API is an applications programming interface. That's the geeky part. It's what lets one program talk to another program. So if I have a medical system and somebody just took an x-ray and I send it to someone, the API is, hey, here's an x-ray. How much are you going to charge me for processing it and telling me what's on it? The thing at the other end could be human sitting, taking those x-rays and looking at them. Could easily be software. And I think you're seeing the implication here, which is once that API has been fulfilled by software and is simply more economical to do, that software replicates by itself all over the place, and that task, however small it is, has just been taken over. It's a hard thing to figure out how to stay above the API.
As you turn your eyes to Hawaii, and here we are, we're not attached to ourselves, we are separated by water, we have to get on planes to visit each other, and we are a destination spot for visitors. What do you see that's particular to Hawaii that you think that we ought to put squarely in front of ourselves, even if it's difficult?
Well, tourism is traditionally, and I think into the future, a high-touch business. If you were led around a city by a robot who, you know, just spieled the script every time you passed by a monument, I don't know that that would be as interesting as getting to know people. And things like Airbnb, for example, are letting people stay in parts of places that tourists don't normally go to. There's usually kind of a tourist hub where the big hotels are, and now we're seeing people disappear into all corners of places, which is great. And I think tourism will remain pretty high touch. The problem is sort of there's this other problem you mentioned, which is housing prices. And this is happening everywhere in the U.S. where there's a desirable piece of real estate, is that the people who are doing service jobs can't afford to stay in the places. In places like San Francisco, what they have to do is migrate way out to the suburbs and then spend a lot of money and time getting in and out of the city. But at least there's a place outside, whereas in Hawaii, the real estate is obviously really limited. So I'm not sure how that plays out. I think what you see there is more pressure to automate more service positions, and then public policy crises or underemployment or underprovisioning of services or something like that. But to find a silver lining, maybe as people are unemployed in trucking, they find employment in higher touch aspects of tourism, for example. And then agriculture and manufacturing, which are both really huge in Hawaii, they're going to go through waves of automation. So I don't know how many of those jobs will actually survive.
We have yet to talk about healthcare. And in Hawaii, as we know already, we have a doctor shortage, a nursing shortage. We have a lot of people who are aging. I think we have the longest live population of any of the states. And that looks like that's going to continue. What do you see coming our way in particular that might help to ease that crisis a little bit and that might be based in AI?
Well, healthcare and nursing are pointed to a lot. In particular, what are sort of called pink-collar occupations or care occupations, care work, tends to be high-touch work, tends to be hard-to-automate work. Again, one of the sort of silver linings of an aging population and what's happening on the other side of automation, which is the disappearance of jobs, is that there will probably be more and more work taking care of our aging population. Doctors should be seeing all sorts of amplification technologies now between diagnostics and tools and remote surgery and all kinds of things that at least enable doctors that are there to do more things. But I think there's some trends that might favor healthcare being okay in these trends.
Thank you very much for giving us this overview, and we'll look forward to talking to you sometime soon.
I appreciate the time very much.
Jerry Mikulski is the founder of the Relationship Economy Expedition. It's a private collaborative inquiry into the next economy. From 1987 to 1998, he was a technology analyst and says he was fortunate to be on duty when the Internet showed up. The next installment of our periodic series, The Last Job in Hawaii, is in 2 weeks, but you can catch a longer conversation that I had with Jerry Mikulski. It's now on our website. Just look under Talk Shows for the conversation.
People.
Made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. Nearly 800 homeless families live here. Half of these have young children. Estimates suggest up to 7,000 individuals are on the street right now. While mental illness can be a factor, we have three main types of homeless here. Locals who hit hard times, people who moved here and lost their jobs, and itinerants who came to avoid the cold winters. The homeless are impossible to ignore, but there are laws which attempt to hide them from visitors. These inspired the song, "There is no sleeping allowed in Hawaii." Some think throwing money at it will solve the problems, and others want more shelters or better access to technology. The Hawaii Community Foundation's program, Housing ASAP, offers a different solution. Yes, there's some money involved, but the plan is to increase the number of families in permanent housing and reduce the time required to stabilize them. The goal? Keep them from slipping back onto the streets. And all of us can help with that. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
Aloha, I'm Jeffrey Siegel, concert pianist, keyboard conversations. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation by following us on Twitter. Our handle is at HI Conversation.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. And Bert, we just heard Beth Ann talk about the possibility of automated tour guides, and that kind of feeds right into your subject, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure does. You know, the recognition is that one of our major industries, which is tourism, is also very interested in what kinds of new technology might enhance the visitor experience. So we were able to take part in the recent HTA tourism conference that took place about a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, there were some interesting things that were featured there, and we wanted to talk about a couple of them, one of them being, you know, sort of this facial recognition and being able to determine by how you respond to certain sort of videos what you might be more interested in. And that might lead into that whole idea of, you know, the AI and, you know, having sort of an automated concierge and, you know, just being able to select different things that you might be interested in. Another one is virtual reality and looking at providing some experience in a virtual world of some of the cool things that could happen in Hawaii.
Bert, what's the role of facial recognition? Does it, you can use facial recognition to determine what someone's preferences might be?
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about it on the show, but basically the underlying technology is that you are watching a video. You opt in to whether or not you want to take part in this sort of facial recognition service, and then what you do is you watch this video and you see different things. Could be an outdoor thing, could be a nightclub thing, could be a dinner thing, and what happens is that they are able to determine, based on your facial responses, what you might be most interested in.
That's almost a little scary, Bert.
Well, you opt in, so it's not like it's, you know, spying on you.
Well, that's comforting, at least. Thanks a lot.
Sure thing.
That's Bite Marks Cafe tonight at 5 p.m. In today's backyard quiz, we remember the 19th century British admiral who found, back in 1843... that an officer under his command had exceeded his authority. It's not every day that a naval captain seizes control of a neutral nation, but that's exactly what Captain Lord George Paulet did. His bizarre six-month occupation of the islands, triggered by a local land dispute involving British subjects, saw the Union Jack raised over the islands and the destruction of Hawaiian flags. The so-called Paulet Affair ended when Paulet's commanding officer sailed to Oahu on his flagship, the HMS Dublin, met with Kamehameha III, and told him that Great Britain had no intention of taking over his kingdom. The Kingdom of Hawaii's flag was raised again in a Honolulu park whose pathways were laid out in the shape of a Union Jack. The park, Thomas Square, was named in honor of Rear Admiral Richard Darton Thomas.
And Ross Uehara called us from Mililani, knew the answer, and will be the recipient of our T-shirt. Thanks so much for playing the Backyard Quiz. And now if you've got a quiz question for us, you can send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. It's now 8:48.
We all want to end our lives with dignity and familiar surroundings, but life doesn't always make that easy. Money is always an issue, and sometimes our own family stands in the way. Older people can find themselves in a situation where their loved ones are making decisions about their lives, talking around them as if they weren't there. It's frustrating, and Alexandra, the central character in the play The Velocity of Autumn, isn't about to stand for it. Vanita Ray Smith is directing the Actors Group production. She's on the phone with us this morning. Good morning, Vanita.
Oh, well, good morning, Chris, and thank you for the opportunity to talk about this wonderful and powerful play.
Yeah, well, powerful in the sense that Alexandra has come up with what I hope, at least, is a unique solution to her problem.
Well, I think that's what has to happen when everyone experiences it. You know, if you live long enough, you've got to make these kinds of decisions. But when she starts making her homemade cocktail bombs, you know, things brighten up. And it is a dramatic comedy, I think, and I've got a wonderful cast. So,
well, the whole she surrounds herself with Molotov cocktails.
And, yes, she does.
And says, if
yes,
you try
does.
To take
she's
me out of here.
To blow up the place if yeah. they just don't listen to her.
Yeah. That whole
I've got a wonderful cast. Joe Pruden is playing Alexandria, and of course everyone knows she's one of our favorite actors in town, and Peter Tagawa is playing her son. So it's a 90-minute romp, and they're just wonderful together. I've done almost 100 shows with Joe over the last 45 years, And Peter did a lot of 12 shows for me out at Army Community Theater. And they've just struck a note here that I think everyone ought to see.
The Sun.
I believe that Velocity of Autumn is going to be one of the best plays in Honolulu this season.
Vanita, the Sun shows up. She hasn't seen him in 20 years, right?
He's been away for 20 years, and she lives on the second floor. And since she's got her room all locked up, they can't get in. So he climbs up the tree and climbs through the window and gets in there.
And that's where the action of the play begins, right?
That's how it begins.
With the Sun.
And he climbs through the window, and they go for 90 minutes of just fun and laughter with memories and what are we going to do, and the telephone ringing and constant interruption from the other two children who are downstairs wanting to call the cops and come in and get her.
So they're at the kids, the offspring, are at the end of their rope as far as dealing with this. They just want her out of there, right?
Yeah, they feel like, well, I think we all go through that. I've been through it with my mother, but they do best when they get to stay in their own surroundings.
Oh, yeah.
They really do. You know, it's this change that is very striking. And I think people who've experienced their parents with a bit of senility and then a bit of dementia or Alzheimer's can recognize that. But if you can just keep them at home, it's wonderful.
It's getting to be more and more prevalent as people are living longer in our society. So, yeah, it's likely to affect a great many people. But in the process, Alexandra gets in some pretty pithy comments about the whole situation.
Oh, she does. She does. She's sharp as a tack, except when she's, you know, gets a long story going and then she gets lost. But Peter, the son, is able to get her back on track.
What kind of relationship do they have after 20 years? Is it? It has to be pretty fraught, I would think.
Well, you know, there's a lot of a few nasty remarks about that. I mean, you know, why did he take off for 20 years? And that's, you know, over the period of the real time, it's explained to us, and we find out that they're too much alike.
What you're asking of particularly of two actors who are pretty much on stage without interruption, right?
90 minutes. There are no interruptions. You know, it's start to finish, the 90 minutes, and they're on stage the whole time. I said, that's very hard when you're starting to memorize lines and you've got, you know, 45 minutes of dialogue for each character.
Well, you also have a peculiar arc of the relationship because they obviously know each other well, and yet there has been that 20-year gap. So I would think that over the course of the 90 minutes, you would have to have sort of a different awareness of one another, that they would be sort of getting acquainted once again, yeah?
Yes, they do, and they have to get reacquainted, just like you said, but they do it. But it takes time.
Yeah.
It takes memories. It takes, well, what are you doing now? Why haven't you called? Why didn't you check in?
That's going to resonate.
Peter says, like mother, like son. That's what she was doing in her young life.
So there's a part of her that entirely understands where her children are coming from.
Yeah,
like.
I think so.
But
I do believe it's going to be a treat for everyone who will come and see it. I think it's just one of those pieces that is universal, and as they develop their characters over the course of 90 minutes and they go back right where they were, they do love one another, as mother and son do.
Well, that's an arc to be traveled right there, because obviously when the son arrives, he's walking into a very difficult, literally potentially explosive situation.
Yes,
right?
It is explosive. Very good term.
Yeah, I mean,
but the other two children have called him because they can't do anything with her. So this is a last resort, and he's got to come up with some kind of a peace treaty.
Sounds like a comedy with a great deal of bite to it.
Yes, it does. There's a lot of bite.
But, you know, that's a good way for a message to hit home when it comes with a laugh, don't you think?
Well, yeah. And you know, sometimes the funniest laughter comes in the matter of drama, because then it becomes sort of melodrama.
Yeah. Well, that's your job, right, to keep it from veering into melodrama or to...
Exactly, and keeping it real.
Yeah.
And the pacing and the phrasing that we've done with the show, and the blocking is like dancing to, you know, she's so crippled up, but she wants to keep struggling and moving around in her apartment. And you know, that's important that she can still move. It takes her forever to get out of the chair, but once she's up and at 'em, she is up and at 'em.
I think a lot of people will find that a familiar story.
Exactly.
Thanks so much for talking with us.
And after he climbs into the window, I think he's experiencing it too. I mean, he's not a young man either.
She's
80, you know, he's got to be 50, 55.
Yeah, he doesn't climb through windows quite as well as he used to. Thanks so much for talking with us, Vanita. Good luck with the show. Vanita Ray Smith is the director of the Actors Group production of The Velocity of Autumn, which opens Friday and runs until November 20th at the Brad Powell Theater on Evelay Road in Honolulu. Details can be found on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Oh, the days dwindle down to a precious few.
Well, thanks for that, mood depressed.
I'll set for a sad note on which to... But it's like Kurt Vile's beautiful September song. And, of course, the velocity of autumn, and the title of the play, refers to the speed at which old age overtakes us, which I wouldn't know anything about.
Good. I'm very glad to hear that. Well, we hope you don't know anything about that yet either, or just simply choose to ignore it. That's a good strategy, too. As for... what we heard about that play, some people are going to recognize that as being so close to home, trying to negotiate with someone who is just not going to go into any sort of assisted living home, no matter what, no matter who, no matter when.
You betcha.
Well, we're going to leave that for the moment and take a forward look at a little later today. Very excited that we're going to be getting HPR 2 to East Hawaii. Boy, it's a long time in coming. Been getting lots of good feedback and tweets and messages. Thank you so much. We'll be very happy when that happens later today. Meanwhile, for tomorrow, well, Planned Parenthood is celebrating its first century, but what's the agenda for just maybe the next 5 years? We're going to find out from Chris Charbonneau, the CEO of Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest.
And if you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
And if you missed any of the show, you can always look on the archive. It's at hawaiipublicradio.org. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation.
I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you tomorrow morning back here with more of the Conversation.